Welcome back, everybody, to another breakdown here on the C-Squared channel. We are in the semifinals of the World Cup with three spots going to the candidates. So obviously, huge fights are happening in two respective matches, one of them between the two Uzbek players, Javohir Sindarov and Nodirbek Yakuboyev, as well as the big clash between Wei and Andriy Osipenko. And right now we're recording this as the semifinals have just finished. So we're going to give you the breakdown, who made it to the candidates, and who Fabiano will be meeting later on in April 2026 in Cyprus, and whether Fabi is excited about who he's going to meet. So Fabi, Big clashes. The World Cup is kind of winding down, but these are the most important and tense moments of the competition. Obviously, some interesting results. Break them down for us.
Yeah, it's... the tournament's been going on a long time. I mean, basically, clutch chess felt like a million years ago, right? But that was right before, like the day before the World Cup.
Yep.
And these guys have been playing many matches. It's a long event. And they still have one more match to play. Even after the semis, nobody gets knocked out, right? Even the losers still have to play that match for third place, which is, you could argue, even more important than the match for first place. You could argue.
Right.
It depends on how much weight you put onto the accomplishment of winning the World Cup versus the accomplishment of qualifying for the candidates, because, of course, the two finalists already qualified. They're fighting for the ultimate win in the tournament. And the other two are fighting for, you could argue, I mean, the chance to become world champion, so you could argue it's more important. Although, of course, it's not a great chance. It's, you know, the candidates, we've already discussed how difficult it is to make it through, and you know, if you give everyone a 1 in 8 chance, then it's obviously not the biggest chance in the world, but still, it's a chance, and it's the biggest chance that that most players get, right? Not many people get to play the candidates. Anyway, the semifinal match is between four players we discussed already, and you just mentioned them. I would say that there's this, in general, you know, narrative about how the World Cup is full of surprises. Sure, it's true. I mean, it's not like you see, like, let's say, a final of Gukesh, Arjun, Vincent, and Prague, right? It's not all the reigning favorites. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's not guys that are, you know, they're all capable, very capable. So it's not a surprise in that sense. So I'm not sure if the narrative of, like, full of surprises, it's just the nature that, I guess, it's a knockout. So people get knocked out, and in that sense, you know, you see on paper rating favorites getting knocked out, but some of them have to. It's also just the nature of the tournament and probability.
I think it just speaks to the variance of a knockout format. Like, you're going to get way more surprises over a short match format rather than, you know, a long open tournament. I mean, you could argue that it's more predictable than the knockout format. I think it just speaks to the format and the fact that, look, these players are very, very close in strength. Even the 2650s to the 2720s are somewhat close in strength. But and we've seen a lot of those matches being decided in shorter time controls, where the ratings are even, let's say, closer than in classical.
Yeah. I mean, I would say if you have a 27, like, let's say, let's take Sindarov, who was about 27-20 before the tournament and now is about 27-25. Gain a bit of rating. And then you take a 2750, like, let's say, Wei, for example, who I think was like 2752, now he's 2756, something along those lines, also gained a bit of rating. Then in a two-game match, it's about as close to 50-50 as you can get. I mean, maybe it's like 52-48, maybe it's 55-45, but it's a coin flip for the most part. But at the end of the day, I mean, the four players we see in the final, they're all players who are currently over 2,700. I think Yakubov has crossed 2,700 during this tournament. Okay, so you can argue it's a new development for him, but I would also say that him specifically, I've noticed, even though his rating hasn't been, let's say, in the top 30 consistently, he actually has won a lot of tournaments for his rating.
You know, one of the most common questions I get is, how do you actually learn a new opening? Honestly, the best way, hands down, is by using chessreps.com. They've got these super fun, interactive opening courses that actually work. This isn't one of those chess courses you watch once and forget. These are fully interactive courses. You're not passively listening. You're actively playing the moves, getting quizzed on variations, and building that crucial muscle memory. It feels more like a game than studying. Hundreds of thousands of players have already used chessreps.com to break through plateaus and hit their highest ever ELO. And here's the cool part. They actually want you to see how powerful this is for yourself. Right now, you can take their entire Vienna Gambit and Stafford Gambit courses completely free. You don't even have to sign up. Just head over to chessreps.com and start learning. Right now, they have 25 courses for you, and they release a new one every single week. Seriously, this is the best way to learn openings. Go try it out at chessreps.com.
Like you normally see that, let's say, guys who are 2650 to low 2700s, they're very good, consistently good, but they don't tend to win many tournaments. Mm-hmm. Because to win tournaments, you very often need a 2800 plus performance. And he's one of the guys who's been in that rating range, who's won, I can count just off the top of my head, Qatar Masters, the Ooze Chess event. I think last year, not this year, I think it was Prague who won. But last year, I think in a share with other Noderbeck, Abdus Tarov. I think there's some other one that he's won. So he's won like high profile events. He's not a newcomer in that sense. Sindarov is not a newcomer either. I mean, we've seen his name for a few years and competing at the top level, let's say in freestyle, for example, this year, you know, beating Hikaru in a tight match, playing a tight match against me as well. You know, definitely having the capability to beat top players, to play at the top level. Wei, we don't have to say much. He's been a top player for 10 years or so. You know, he's been like 27, let's say 30, 40, 50 for a decade now. Mm-hmm. It's, mm-hmm. And Yesipenko also has been 27, 20 4 years ago. So he's also a seasoned guy. So at the end of the day, I'm not, like, I don't find it a shocking Final Four, you know? It's maybe not the 1, 2, 3, 4 of the tournament by initial ranking, but it's no shock in my mind.
Absolutely. And just to add up to your point about Yakubov, he's been winning tournaments. He's been winning open tournaments against the elite, but he's also very much used, I would say, to not only high level performances in individual tournaments, but also in team events. And he's been around all of these extremely, extremely strong guys like Sindarov, who's also been making his push, as well as Abdusatorov. He's been around those guys and he's been training with those guys for a very long time. Let's not forget the fact that he won alongside the Uzbek team, the 2022 Olympiad in Chennai, right? So that was a huge result, of course. So he's accustomed to playing against the best, training with the best, and also winning against the best. I think that speaks volumes to the fact that he was just lagging a little bit behind, but he was ready for that breakthrough performance. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now.
Yeah.
Sindarov, I mean, Sindarov, you know him already. You've been battling against him in freestyle chess in this past year. So I think he already kind of made that jump to the elite level, wouldn't you say so?
Yeah. When I played him in 2023 Grand Swiss in Isle of Man, that was the first time I played him. He was probably about 2670 or so. And I was playing with the white pieces, and I noticed kind of two things. First, when preparing for the game, I noticed his openings were very risky. One could argue not the best openings.
Mm-hmm.
And when playing the game, the game ended in a draw. I noticed that he both calculated very well and played very well. And I think I gave an interview after the game, and I basically said that I thought he would cross to the like low 2700s pretty soon, and I don't even think that was a very bold prediction. I mean, just based on that game alone, it felt like he was already very capable. So that's not a surprise at all. I think you could argue that like Yakubov is a surprise because he doesn't have maybe the consistency, but certainly not a tremendous surprise. And Yesipenko also, I don't find it surprising at all that he made it to the semis. You know, it's of course like on paper, sure, Prague is going to be a favorite against Yakubov, against Yesipenko. On paper, Gukesh is going to be a favorite against Sindarov, let's say, on paper. But it's very close. It's one of these like 55-45 things. So, and Wei Yi, I just consider like pre-tournament, you just have to consider him one of the favorites. I mean,
100%.
But when I say one of the favorites, it's like maybe there's 10 favorites. You give them all a 5% chance, let's say. I mean, it's not, there's not a lot of equity in this tournament because there's so many players and you have to win. To win this tournament, you have to win 7 matches. To get to the semis is more manageable. It's, you know, you have to do well, but like we've discussed the paths of the players. Like, for example, Yakubov, he was actually favorite in all of his matches until the semis, but the reigning favorite. He wasn't a favorite to get through every one of them because, of course, it's a lot of matches, but he was a favorite in each individual match by rating. Sindarov, I'm not sure. I think maybe Sindarov played someone who was higher rated than him. Let me see.
I'll tell you. Sindarov did
not
play.
No, he didn't, actually.
Yu Yang-Yi was close, but not really. Yes.
Yeah, they're basically...
Actually, he's 5 rating points higher than him.
Yeah, but they're... I mean, yeah, this is a negligible amount of rating, right? So...
Yeah.
It's actually, well, part of the reason for that was also because we did have these early knockouts, like Wesley, for example. I think he was in Yakubov's bracket. Noderbeck. I forget which bracket he was in, but Noderbeck, Abdusatarov.
Mm-hmm. He lost against Jose Martinez, so he was in the same bracket.
Yeah. And anyway, we saw a lot of early departures. Hans, for example, you know, famously my pick. Anyway, let's get to the matches and what happened in the semis.
Let's do it.
The one interesting
thing. So what do we
have?
Noderbeck versus Sindarov. Yakubov versus Sindarov. Let's start with that match.
Yeah, this is the classical portion. I just have to say one thing for both of these matches. Like the World Cup has a ton of interesting games early on, and then for the semis, the classical games kind of lose. Well, I mean, it's not always the case, but in this particular event, the semis, the classical games just lose any content. Like there were basically like two interesting moves in both semifinal matches, and they both.
Why do you think that's the case?
I mean, it's partly circumstance, just how the openings turn out, and then partially also the players are playing it safe. Like the second game of Yevakir was white against Noderbeck, and he just killed the game. 4 knights with bishop e5, knight d4, knight d4. That's a draw for. So that game was drawn from the opening, basically. The first game, it looked like Yakubov just didn't get anything from the opening, didn't know the line sufficiently well to pose problems. The game had very minor content. It was basically stable throughout. In none of the games in either semifinal match was anyone objectively better for any moment. Like you could only say that in the first classical game, Yesipenko was slightly better, not objectively, but practically a tiny bit better in the first game with black. It had like a nice tactical finish, but people, I think, made a big deal out of it. But they didn't need to, because it was, although it's nice, it wasn't super difficult. And I think the game was always super balanced. The chess.com engine kind of gave a bit of a optimistic assessment, which I think, like, strong engines just show that it's basically level throughout.
It was a slight amount of pressure, the type of pressure that in many instances, especially when the nerves are at an all-time high, you know, they sometimes make people crack. But Wei did defend very accurately, and he did finish it off with a very nice tactical sequence, I think. Yeah, as you pointed out, a lot of people were quite impressed with his resilience under fire.
I was so happy that we had this incredible highlight, because otherwise, seemingly, if Andrei plays queen f5, and then he grinds, but after 2 hours, he holds, then we say that, okay, nothing really happened today. It was fighting game, but like this, we got a spectacle.
Yeah.
Yeah, this queen e4 bishop takes a6.
Beautiful, yeah. Actually.
Yeah. Yeah, no, of course, it can, like, these things can go wrong. I think, like, one of the reasons I was a little bit, like, okay, bishop takes a6, and he was pretty sure about the calculation, e5, rook d8, like, you should play rook d8, and then after king a7, you have to see queen a4 in advance, otherwise, well, I mean, I guess you could just luckily run into it, but of course he saw queen a4 in advance, and then rook d7, it's a nice finish, mm-hmm. With a perpetual. But instead of bishop a6, for example, rook e1 is also, I think, if you feed it to, like, a strong engine, it's also evaluating it as just a draw.
Mm-hmm.
Which just shows that white's position, like, the position is kind of, I mean, black is up a pawn, but it's weak pawns, and white has pretty well-placed pieces, so endgames look very drawish, you know. So bishop a6 wasn't strictly necessary, like, in case, I think basically, like, let's say, when he went for the position after queen h5, what commonly you have is, like, you've calculated bishop a6, it looks like it works, but it also feels very nice if you have, like, a backup that, you know, okay, if I play rook e1, for example, it's not that bad. You know, I'm not losing the game for sure.
Yeah.
It's not ideal, maybe, but it's not that bad. It really helps you psychologically take the decision to go for the position where you also feel like, okay, bishop a6, I've calculated enough, but just in case I miss something, I'll be able to reconsider. He took like 4 minutes for bishop a6, so I'm sure he had calculated it before and then was just double checking that, okay, e5, rook d8, and I threatened mate in one, so that kind of eases my calculations. Black has one check on h1, doesn't change matters, especially. And then the only important thing to see is this queen a4. That's, you know, if you miss a move like king to a7, you know, that could be a disaster. But queen a4 is a nice. And it feels a bit like, okay, there's some checks here and there, but the thing is, it's a discovered check. So if there's, like, bishop f5, there's bishop d3, right? There's this discovered check, which helps a lot with your assuredness that the calculations are working out. Anyway, that was the only game in the semis in the classical portion that had any content. Yeah. I mean, the rest was just, like, safety first and both of the games between the Uzbek players were like 100% accuracy from start to finish with no deviation, and just not, to be honest, not super exciting, but that's kind of the nature of, like, it's high stakes. You know, people don't want to take risks in classical, because it feels like if you lose in classical, you can't come back. If you lose in rapid, okay, there's always a chance to come back because of the shortened time control, you know, it's adds a bit more variance and so on. You don't want to lose in classical, right? That's the main thing.
Would you weigh, because we've seen this decision more or less from players, again, in the second game, players with the white pieces generally have force matters and decided to make a quick draw, not pose too many problems. Would you weigh the fact that you continue into the rapid and then you have two games more as more favorable, or at least easier to manage than trying to get an advantage with the white pieces and risking it a bit more with the white pieces?
So it's kind of a matter of taste, in some sense. I would I don't know exactly what I would do at this tournament situation because it's also late into the tournament. Maybe I don't have so many fresh ideas. Maybe I don't really want to repeat a lot of lines. It takes a lot of energy. And you can just take that very chill approach, which is, mm-hmm. I'm not going to prepare for this game. Just make a draw. My opponent will not object to forcing drawn lines. I don't really have to prepare, and we can work on some kind of rapid ideas, opening ideas for the rapid games. Very practical, very pragmatic. A lot of people take this approach. Maybe I would do it too. It would also depend mm-hmm. on my energy levels. On the other hand, maybe I want to be principled because I also know my opponent is nervous. They're probably, have to prepare a lot with the black pieces because they don't want to get caught in the opening. They don't know if I'm going to play for a win or not. So they might suspect that I want to draw. Sure, it's always a consideration. But maybe I also want to use that fact, like they're hoping that I'll go for the draw and that I actually want to play a game and I go for a sharp
exactly.
fight. It's a bit of psychology. It's very, you just judge it in the moment. There's a lot of things to consider. And above all, your form, your tiredness, your energy levels. And also, do you have ideas in the opening? You don't want to spend hours and hours trying to create from scratch. So
you sort of have to, though, at that point, right? Because you've already gone through a whole tournament and you probably ran out of ideas at this point in the event. I mean,
sure.
So deep
yeah,
into
possible.
The event, you've played so many games, you probably kind of utilized all of your ideas pre-tournament.
That's also possible. But on the other hand, you find ideas in the moment as well. So maybe you don't use all of them. Maybe some of them you find and then they stay on the table. Anyway, that's a very individual approach and also very situation dependent, I would say. So Sindarov decided to force the draw and go into rapid, which is it's a fair approach. Like maybe half the time it doesn't work, half the time it works, but it's a fair approach either way. And then it went to rapid. And I have to say Sindarov was very impressive. I think that he played a great rapid match. So the first game, he stuck to his guns and he got a good opening. He played the semi-slav again. He played the Cambridge Springs, which quickly turned into a sort of Carlsbad, as it often does. Then a very unusual Carlsbad because Yakubov went for bishop f4 e5, which I don't actually think is a very good decision. I would definitely be critical of this, especially in hindsight. But he went for it quickly, so maybe he had something here ready. But Sindarov got a fairly nice position. And the reason I'm a bit critical is because even if you prepare this with white, it feels like black has just far too many moves to really keep control of the situation. And the strategic risk is pretty high for white.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what we saw. Like, it was just easy for black to play after, like, let's say move 19. We kind of have matters have clarified a bit. Like, the bishop was traded for the knight. Actually, both bishops were traded for both knights. And it feels like e5 is a weakness. And to me, it just looks like very easy to play for black. I'm going to castle. I'm going to play f6 at some point. I have the very nice pawn structure because the queenside pawn formation is going to be really nice in the endgame. It feels like black, because okay, the e5 pawn is a weakness, but also if it gets traded for the f pawn, then black has the open files on the king side and the better structure on the queen side. The knight is not an inferior piece. Now that being said, it's probably about equal, but you know, there's like objective equality, and then there's positions that, especially in rapid, are easier to play. This one I would definitely take in rapid with the black pieces.
Somewhat different, obviously, and it's not the same type of imbalance and not the same pieces on the board, but the structure reminds me a little bit of the game that we analyzed in our previous masterclass, the one between Levon and Eric Aissi. Also, the light square bishop kind of biting on granite, and then, the knight jumping around and utilizing the weakness of the structure as well. Like, sure, yeah. In that case, there was a pawn on d4. That was the weak pawn. In this case, the pawn on e5 seems to be the anchor that we're going to try to use.
Yeah, if you imagine, for example, that the e and f pawns get traded, then the difference between this and that game in the structure would be the pawn on e3 was on d4 in that game, which it's definitely better on e3 because
of course
it can be Well, it is defended by its neighboring pawns. It's not a pawn island. It's not one an isolated pawn in the center, which can be attacked, but isn't so easy to defend. The advantage for black here is that the a-file is open. Like, in that game, there was no doubled b-pawns. And the doubled b-pawns help black a lot because you open the a-file. And also, you can use the b-pawn as kind of, I don't know if you want to call it a battering ram or whatever you want, but at some point, black will have the levers on the queen side to be able to play b4 and potentially open the a-file. We actually see that way in the future, but it's always something that's annoying for white. That, like, your b2, a3 formation, you also can't move your b-pawn, because then a3 becomes chronically weak. If black's pawn was on a6, for example, white could play b4, and then you just kind of lock down black's pawn majority. So that pawn on b5 is a really important trump for black.
Yeah.
And then when he got queen c5, it started to look really unpleasant to me. Because, you know, you attack e5, and then once white plays f4, then you play f6 eventually, and then the e-pawn becomes a weakness, which is exactly what happened. Okay, first he maneuvered the knight to b6, which is a great maneuver. I wonder, maybe he should have, I don't know, if he should eliminate the knight on a4 when he had the chance by playing bishop takes a4. But to be honest, probably not. I mean, maybe he should have played b3. Because after rook b1, knight b6, then... But you play b3, okay, you allow the knight to c3, though. But at least you don't allow the knight to c4. Because the problem with the knight on c4 is you can't kick it out, because now a3 is just too weak. Yep. And if you trade it off, then black's structure gets even more entrenched in white's position, which is exactly what happened. He played bishop takes c4 eventually, and then bc4, and then black plays b5. And this pawn mass, you can imagine getting very scary, because a pawn on c4, it's not a passed pawn, but it's very close to becoming a passed pawn in the future. Like, imagine just like visually in your head, put black's pawn on c5 from c6 and put the king on c6. And now we're threatening d4 and d3 and all, you know, e3 is a weakness. This is a very unpleasant endgame.
It looks terrible.
If not simply bad. Terrible. Now the question is, like, when did it go from bad to lost? This probably has like two answers. One is maybe the objective one, which, you know, I don't know exactly when it was completely lost, because it's endgames are complicated. Maybe already after he played rook c1, for example. But certainly after rook c1, it's practically lost, because, you know, the rest was just like, it just flowed so easily. There was basically, not only was there no resistance, I don't even know where he could have put up resistance. I mean, it just looks
basically so miserable. It says that white perhaps should have went for b3, but this is such a tough decision to make, right?
Instead of g3, right?
Instead of king f3 first, and then instead of...
Oh, but after king f6, I already think it's maybe objectively lost, or yeah, I don't believe in white's survival there.
You don't think even g3 will... all the way down, yeah.
Yeah, because, like, a move later, the e3 pawn was a bit too vulnerable. But the move before g3, if he plays b3, okay, so if rook a3, there's bc4, so b7 is attacked. So black can either play b5 or cb3, rook b3, b5. And if b5, then we play a4, and although we sack a pawn, we do like start to break up black's pawn formation, and also we get our rooks active. So it feels like very good drawing chances there. So maybe he would instead play cb3, rook b3, b5, keeping the pawn formation, keeping the a3 weakness. But, you know, then, I mean, it still looks very unpleasant to me. But maybe you could play rook d4, king f3, e4, and eventually start to liquidate enough pawns. I mean, so I feel like, from a practical point of view, maybe, like, move 31 was very critical, and after g3, rook e6. Now b3, b5, a4 doesn't seem to be... Well, maybe still a4 here? I don't know. Maybe it was his last chance to play b3. Certainly after rook c1, it starts to feel really bad. So he probably should have taken the opportunity. But the thing is, he has 40 seconds, so it's very tough to change the nature of the position when you have 40 seconds. So he decided on passive defense. I think
you just hit on a very, very good point. The fact that Sindarov was always, by a large margin, ahead on the clock in this game. Like 3 minutes, I see 3 minutes, 20 seconds. I see Yakubov on 20 seconds. He was always the one putting the pressure. So I think it's, I would say unreasonable to expect a very, very precise play when you're defending such an atrocious position with 20 seconds. Yeah. It's just unrealistic.
Yeah, I mean, it's in one sense, it seems ridiculous to say that the loss was caused by the opening, by his choice to play bishop f4 e5, because of course it's not a bad move. But if you look at this time expenditure after bishop to b4 on move 11, here he thought for 3 minutes, and he never actually equalized on the clock after that. So it just felt like Sindarov was feeling the position a bit better, it was easier for him to play, and it just kind of flowed naturally. So it was in some part perhaps a bad opening choice, and in some part also perhaps, you know, a few like poor positional decisions along the way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I feel a little bit strange about his choice to take on b6 as well, but to be honest, you're also very afraid of like losing the e5 pawn, so I can understand. But then you have the open a-file, and that's actually a very important thing. But it's just hard to say in general where it like goes out of control. But it was a slow, methodical process,
mm-hmm.
which perhaps culminated in this rook c1, which feels like the beginning of the end. And then after that, it just, like, the technique was very nice. G5, for example, that was a nice move. I liked all of Sindarov's decisions. I mean, I see the engine shows that, like, maybe on move 39, rook f4 is perhaps holding, but it doesn't feel like rook f4, and then I can play dc4. Okay, it's similar to the game, but now a bit more active for white. And then you play, like, e4 or something, but you don't break up black's pawn formation. So these three pawns, they kind of stay there. And from a practical point of view, I don't see you saving this. Maybe, you know, maybe you do, but by accident, not because you have it under control.
You stumble upon it, more or less.
Yeah, yeah. Like, of course, things can always go out of control. You know, it's tough to win games, especially if your opponent doesn't make blunders.
But like, for example, After rook d8, e5, if you take on f4, take and king to f5, this looks very dangerous to me. Okay, now I understand rook to e3 perhaps might be the only move that saves white. But you have 20 seconds to understand all of these things. Not easy.
I mean, I'm not sure if you survive, but if you do, it's definitely not obvious. Because after I play rook e8, then I'm, again, now I have ideas of c5 and then b4. And if you allow c5 b4, you just lose because my pawns, they just run. So, you know, maybe you hold this, maybe you don't. But it's not something where you ever have it under control. It's just that, of course, accidentally you can, you know, your opponent can make mistakes. So you will see later on a major blunder that happened when you least expect it. But then after he played a4, which, to be honest, I think a mistake is going to come here no matter who you are. You could be the best defender in the world. A mistake is going to come. And a4 was certainly the end, and absolutely the end with no question. Because after rook a8, the rook came in. So white's king was forced back because king issued rook f2 is simply mate, forced mate. So the king is forced back. And after cb5, both black has two connected passed pawns and the second rank, and white's king is very passive. And then resistance didn't last very long. I mean, you know, he, like, a few more moves, and it was all very clear. Pawn went to c2 and resigned.
Pawn to c2, one square away from promotion. Queen is in the hands of Sindarov. He's ready for rook b1.
He's ready to beat his friend, and there we go. Handshake. Nodibek Yakubov resigns.
Too simple. Yeah, yeah. And that basically puts Sindarov in must-draw situation. You make a draw, you win the match, you get the candidate spot
with white,
and with the white pieces, which obviously is huge.
But a lot of people do
Yakubov
mess this up.
Get any chances? Yes. Did Yakubov get any chances?
Well, it depends if you mean practically or objectively. Objectively, he didn't, but he did get a fight, so you could say practically he did. I was a bit surprised by Sindarov's opening choice, because there's always this, like, you know, we saw, for example, Jose Martinez was always playing the c3 Sicilian in these situations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because, like, if you look at Magnus, whenever he needs to draw with white, plays a C3 Sicilian. Okay, C3 Sicilian is basically that, like, the theory can kind of steer you towards a draw. That's the idea.
Unless you want to take unreasonable chances with black and get them much worse position.
Yeah, for example. Or sometimes your opponent screws up, of course, that can always happen. I had this must win with black against Noderbeck, obviously Tarov, earlier this year, and I played the Sicilian, he played C3 Sicilian, I played a line with E6, B6, and then he just, like, played it rather poorly, and I got immediately winning position. It was just mm-hmm. a gift. But most of the time, C3 Sicilian is a very good way to steer the game towards equality. But
yeah,
Sindarov, he chose basically the sharpest line, or one of the sharpest lines of the Knight Earth, which, you know, when I saw the decision, I thought both it's surprising, but maybe it's just a good decision because...
With respect.
Yeah, like, let's say there's maybe a school of thought that I'll play a little bit less principally to get in a sterile position. Like, I'll play C3 Sicilian, I guess I get some equality, it's a bit sterile, it's a bit annoying for my opponent. But here I'm playing very principled. I'm going to play for an advantage, and then my idea is that, okay, I have an advantage, even if it's sharp, still, I have the better position, and I believe that I can play it well. And sometimes it's easier to play a good but sharp position rather than to play an equal and boring one, because the equal boring one, maybe it takes forever and ever and eventually goes out of control. And the good one, which is sharp, it can go out of control at the very start, but I always have that feeling like, okay, I'm playing from a position of strength because let's say my opponent is... okay, it's not like the Knight Orf with H3 is bad for black, but he chose to play E6 and Knight D7, which is a little bit questionable. Modern mm-hmm. theory says, okay, I'll play E5, right, after H3, which is its own theoretical story.
Yeah,
we don't know what Sindarov wanted there, but certainly he had something in mind. But Yakubov decided to play basically the most combative way, keeping all the tension, keeping the structure very flexible, but accepting an objectively a little bit worse position.
Would you say that perhaps his opening choice is also a byproduct of these two players knowing each other so well, and perhaps Sindarov knows where, you know, the tender spots are in Yakubov's repertoire and what he's not the greatest at?
I mean, I can only speculate. Like, I know they've played quite a number of classical games. I know that they've played on the same team together. They've probably discussed chess to some degree, but... Mm-hmm. Can I say that if I know they've ever worked together seriously? I honestly have no idea. So I can't speculate too much into that.
Right.
But they certainly have some familiarity with each other. I mean, my guess would just be that Sindarov prepared this line and then he just decided to stick to his guns. I mean, it's actually a fair approach. It might be the best approach. It's just a strategic question and people will have different feelings about it. I think to like recent games I had a few with white must draws and the Grand Chess Tour finals. I had two games with white in final fourth game of Blitz, must draw against Levon, must draw against Maxime. And one I kept complete control and one I lost control and I was losing. Mm-hmm. And they both ended in a draw. The one where I kept complete control, I was always winning and then I just accepted a draw in a winning position. The one where I lost control, I just stumbled into a winning position at the end, and then we made a draw. what was my opening approach in both of them? The one against Levon, I think I chose a very good opening approach. He basically played a slightly dubious opening, and I just played ambitiously. I just thought, I'm better. Like, he played basically a modern, and then I played with bishop d3. He provoked d5, and then I just thought, okay, of course, I can try to keep the center flexible. That's the conventional wisdom. Like, I don't close the structure because if I keep it flexible, it'll probably the center kind of dissolves and pieces get traded. But then I thought, okay, d5 should be the right move. So I didn't hesitate. I just decided I'm going to play the right move. And that was the right approach.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Then against Maxime, I had this thought at some point, like, I should play e5 here. And it does, the position doesn't matter. Basically, e5 is gaining space. And I thought I should gain space here. And I'm probably a bit better. And then I decided, no, it's an equal position. If I don't do that, why don't I just play an equal position? Mm-hmm. And slowly I got worse in an equal position. While if I had just taken the space and played principally, I probably would have gotten a better position than I got. So maybe that's the right approach. And anyway, that's what Sindarov did. And the opening worked very well for him. He was always better, with no exception. And then he just started pushing. F4, F5. And E6 is a weakness, so black already has a very bad position. Then when his knight was attacked, he played bishop D4. The rook on H8 is vulnerable. And now if rook G8, there's knight E3. So basically, he's just maneuvering his knight. So that provoked Yakubov to sack an exchange. Then he played rook H3, stopping queen G3. Very good. DE4. Okay, here he didn't play the best move, but it's still a good move. Just like queen H5 is, for computers, the best move. Okay. Mm-hmm. Also logical. He played knight D5, queen C5, and knight F6, which, you know, now he started to kind of try to simplify the position, which is very understandable. And actually, I wouldn't criticize it because he goes to a very safe endgame. Like after knight c4, if he had played queen d4 without taking, then it's even safer and better than what he did. What he did, take and queen d4, actually kind of safe. So I can't criticize it too much either. He lost all his advantage. But it's still...
It simplifies kind of the position, right?
Yeah. I mean, the commentators, Peter and Jan Gustafsson, they were saying that that basically white's gained in danger, but it didn't feel very dangerous to me. Like, you're going to play king e2, and then if black plays f4, f3, you put your king on like dark squares, and then you play h5, g6, and open up the position. And that was
the
kind of my feeling.
The rooks should have a say later on in the game, right?
Yeah. I think instead of king e7, he should have maybe tried bishop d6. Maybe this was a bit more annoying practically, but it's still an equal position. Instead, he played king d7, and then really nice move b3, opening the b-file. Yeah, maybe after b3, maybe there was something better than f4, because after f4, take, it actually, like, it's not that f4 is an objective mistake, but the position is kind of equal, and after you play f4, it turns into the kind of equal, which is forcing. Well, if he played, like, rook c8, and then he just gets ready, bc4, rook c4, and then he, like, tries to slowly play king e6, f4, king f5, then it's the kind of equal which is less forcing. It's still
makes
equal.
Perfect sense.
And I would say that I don't know. Should I say that, I mean, was Sindarov's approach the best when he played bishop takes c4, for example? Probably not. Probably like queen d4 immediately is a better approach, objectively better move. But he was never in serious danger, and that's really the main thing at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And after he played king d7, b3, f4, bc4, I think basically there's no hope to win this, because suddenly rook b1 becomes a huge threat, and after e3, it looks like the pawns are very dangerous, but then rook d1, and you can't put the king anywhere. If you put it on e6, then there's bishop takes e3.
Mm.
Getting rid of all the pawns, and then after king goes to f5, there's rook d7, and black just starts to lose too many pawns. Yeah, probably black can still hold this, but black is never winning this, just... There's not enough pieces left on the board. You just lose all your pawns.
I think this is probably what he missed. Perhaps
maybe,
that rook d1 is so strong.
And that's why the computer shows like bishop g2 after rook d1. But then I simply play bishop e3.
Yeah.
King goes to c6, rook to h2, bishop to f3, and then we get something similar to the game. Okay, maybe it's a better version for black. Bishop d4 is necessary to basically avoid rook to e8 check. That there's no like bishop f4, there's rook e8, and then you king d2, rook d8. So you have to keep the d file closed. So bishop d4, rook e8, king d2, take bishop a3. Okay, it's a better version of the game. It's still objectively a draw because material is equal. I mean, black does have actually this version for some reason is better for white, but okay. I mean white has
some ideas of c3, rook a2, it seems like.
Yeah. Black has two passed pawns, but they're not too dangerous. They're kind of controlled very well. So that's why he played king c8, which is objectively a losing move, just to avoid the draw. And now I think h5 was a very clean way to do it, because you just threaten rook h4, and there's actually nothing you can do to stop that, and black just loses the game. But it's understandable not to see that move, and the move he played just forces a draw. Bishop b5, bishop g2, rook h2, f3, take king e2. It's sacking the exchange back, but he just eliminates the g2 pawn. And the e3 pawn, one after the other. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah. And at this point, the material is just simply too limited to have any hopes for black.
I mean, there's a few issues. One is that black is actually going to be down a pawn. So That's an issue. The other issue is that Black's A pawn is not far advanced at all. And the other issue is that there's like too many weaknesses for Black. The f7, h7 are weak. Like, you don't have any stability in the position. So it's hard to imagine what can go wrong.
Yeah.
I think Yakubov, to his credit, he actually did create a bit of confusion. After rook h4, it was like, I was watching it live without the engine, and after rook h4, it felt, okay, of course, it looks like a draw, complete draw, but it felt, you know, in time trouble, a little bit scary.
The pawn is going to e2, right? So once the pawn lands on e2, you might get a little bit worried.
Yeah, the issue is the bishop on g5, it defends e7, so if something goes wrong, then that pawn is just unstoppable. But there's too many ways to cover it, and like, he just realized that after king f3, e2, bishop f2 comes, and which is what happened.
Yeah.
Actually, I think that Black could have gotten the position after rook h2 a tempo up, because he could have played e2 instead of giving the checks.
Yes.
But after bishop f2, he actually can't use the tempo. Like, he can play a5 here, but I think there's like one important trick. If I play rook a7 here, I know even this doesn't work. I was thinking like rook a7, there's rook f2, king f2, bishop e3, king e2, bishop a7, but then h6, bishop b8, and apparently king d3. But okay, this gets very
iffy. But you don't want to see this. You definitely don't want to see this.
I don't know why it's a draw exactly, but anyway, instead of rook a7, you can play like rook h8 or something, or rook g7, like something a bit more cautious. But the way that he did it, he also lost the tempo, which makes White's task even easier because he just took on e2 and now the a pawn is not even close enough.
Yeah.
Which is what happened, right? And they simplified to a rook endgame, and that was the game. And with that, Sindar won the match, went to the finals.
The other game in the meantime,
it is a handshake. It's confirmed. Javakir Sindarov is through to the finals of the World Cup, and he's the first player to qualify to the Candidates Tournament. Only 19 years old.
Very, very, very nice and well-deserved. Obviously, the superior player in the rapid portion, just better time management. The knowledge of the opening, especially in the first game, was superior. So definitely the deserved player. I don't think, from what we've seen and what you've showed me, I don't think he was ever worse in this match. So kudos to Sindarov. And then, of course, we move on to a crucial match between two of the players that, in my eyes at least, whenever I saw this match flash, I thought that whoever wins this one is probably going to win the World Cup. The one between Wei and Essipenko, a little bit lower rated than everybody else in the bracket, but again, at his peak, 27-20, I think one of the classiest players remaining, and definitely a player that is capable of beating anybody in the world. So he faces Wei. You sort of showed us already in Classical where he perhaps had some practical pressure. Wei defended very, very well, and then we move on.
Actually, I do have to say, like, the second Classical game, I mean, he had a bit of a pull from the opening. It wasn't ever tremendous, but I mean, Yesipenko was a bit better with White, so should at least acknowledge that there was something there. It wasn't totally dry. I mean, it did turn dry pretty quickly. It certainly wasn't an eventful game, but he did have a bit of a pull. I think at some point, like f4 instead of f3 was, like here f4 was kind of unpleasant because you. H4 becomes a weakness. It's not a ton. It's kind of what you sort of know you might get going into this Petrov line.
Oh, yes. No, I've but had my, I mean, my this fair is the of, best.
My fear of Petrov suffering in this, because, like, you know, when I started playing the Petrov 2016, basically the idea was you castle long in this... in this knight c3 line, you take on c3 and you castle long. That was, people thought it was just dangerous to castle short. That quickly changed. I think in 2018, we also did like a lot of very serious work to also to prove that Black can castle short. And then the theory kind of spiraled from there to the point that basically it's not only considered that you castle short, it's not dangerous, but that Black even has like five different approaches, all of them working. And there's guys like, you know, I've had many discussions with Jan-Christoph Duda, theoretical discussions over the board, not actual discussions. Where I'm playing white and he's playing black because he's a Petrov player, he's defend. Like, I've had so many theoretical battles with him. And also from the black side, I've had theoretical battles with Hikaru, with Levon over the years. A lot of very important theoretical games. I think two against Levon maybe in this. Anyway. And then this long castle, basically, the reason why he castled queenside is because white played bishop to f4. I mean, if you play bishop to e3, then people don't really castle queenside these days too much because it's considered a bit unpleasant. I had this game against Karakin, famously, 2018. I lost in the Canadas, which I eventually won the tournament, but almost cost me the tournament. I lost this game where I castled queenside and got an unpleasant position and just, you know, didn't work out. And then since then, I just castled kingside. You know, I played against Magnus in the match in 2018. The World Championship match, I castled kingside and so on. But bishop to f4, it's considered that castling queenside is a better version now because the bishop on e3 targets the queenside. The bishop on f4, the main idea of this piece is that it stops knight e5 in a lot of lines and also stops c6 in a lot of lines. So it's you know, more aimed against some of Black's ideas if Black is castling short, like c6 d5 is very common, right? Here, if Black castles long, the bishop is going to lose a tempo going back. That's what you'll see, you know? Yeah. Actually, okay, in this version, I mean, he allowed knight g5, so to be honest, he didn't probably play it in the best version, but anyway. That's why he castled long, and then he got this kind of slight suffering that you get in this bishop pair position. It's very common type of position that you have, like, many example games where white achieves this bishop pair, and then very often plays like a4, b, you know, and tries to push on the a4, a5, tries to push on the queen side. And black tries to basically put all the pawns on dark squares and say, I have light squares defended, I have dark squares defended, and what are you going to do about it? So anyway, that's the game. He had like one smaller opportunity after g5. I think it's very hard to create any ideas. And then he started to play a bit weird, like, you know, this whole rook c1, rook e2, rook e1 stuff was not very... very dangerous looking.
Yeah. And then they found the repetition.
Yeah, he could maybe play on a bit, but black is looking extremely solid at this point.
There's not much. Yeah.
So then they went to rapid, which I have to say it was a bit of a strange rapid match. So yeah, let's just start with the first game because it was another Petrov and we got a little bit of a let's say introduction to some of the theory of the Petrov.
Mm-hmm.
And this time the bishop went to f5. Okay, of course,
not Wei... on e6 to get hit by the knight on g5. Yeah. Perhaps Wei did some preparation in between the rounds, yeah?
He definitely prepared again for the line because obviously, even if you think your opponent won't repeat it, there's always a possibility. So,
yeah.
Yespenko prepared this h3 with the. Okay, h3 is kind of a typical waiting move with all these lines. If you castle short, then it maybe prepares g4. If you castle long, then he has bishop b5. It would be stupid to play bishop b5 before black castles long because then you're just inviting black to expand on the queen side.
Yeah, with a6, b5. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then eventually he did expand on the queen side, but of course it's a bit more double-edged when your king is there, right? You potentially weaken some squares. But still, he gets knight a5, and basically at this point, Yespenko starts to think for the first time. Maybe he has some familiarity with the position, but maybe not a whole lot. And probably he was thinking that if I play, like, let's say g4 and allow knight takes b3, ab3, the queen goes somewhere, let's say e4, because it looks very comfortable on c6. That looks like a nice square for the queen in general. Maybe f3 also. And then he probably thought, like, okay, even with b5 weakened, I mean, there's not too many pieces left. The pieces, you know, the rooks get traded on the e-file, the queens get traded at some point because there's so many trading squares. And then, yeah, black's king is not really weak in that sense. Like, imagine the queen on c6, king on b7. Why is that a weak king? So
looks very dry.
So then he played bishop d5, c6, bishop to f3, knight c4, okay, queen d4 is necessary, and then bishop to f6. By the way, black could have also played king b7, but bishop f6 is very forcing. And here he had a choice.
What about queen a7?
Yeah, he can play queen a7, queen f4, king b1. And here I think it's a draw in like a million ways, and he probably wasn't ready for a draw. Like black could play knight e5, for example, and I think white can just make a repetition. Or black even has some stuff like d5. I think I saw Leiko and Gustafsson were discussing this. Bishop g4, rook e6, queen f7, knight b2. Here, actually, it's not a forced draw. Not knight b2 immediately. It's like king b8 first, for whatever reason, queen e6, and now knight b2.
Okay.
It's not a forced draw, but eventually it turns into a draw with correct play. But very understandable not to go for queen a7. So he took on c4, which is maybe a tiny bit of an inaccuracy. He probably thought that after bishop g4, if you take on g4, then I attack two pawns, h7, d6. But then queen e6 is very nice. And if you take on d6, I break the pin, bishop g5 and f5, and I win the game because I actually keep my queen.
That's
so
nice.
After queen e6, you're forced to take, to trade on my terms, because you don't get the g-file open.
Yeah.
And then black just has a nice structure. C3 is kind of a weakness. If you ever play B3, that pawn is kind of fixed on that square. If you don't play B3, then you're never liquidating black's pawn. It's not a majority because there's the same amount of pawns, but it feels like a majority because black's pawns are more advanced.
It looks slightly unpleasant. Just slightly. Yeah.
No, I think it actually looks very unpleasant. And the main issue is that it's an enduring advantage. You don't have a way to simplify matters. And then he took on e6, which made it feel to me a bit even more strategically dangerous, because now black has this really nice pawn formation. And eventually, if we get like c5, king c6, e5, d4, that's actually looking like a very threatening pawn majority.
Yeah.
Then he played a5. He
Similar to what
a4.
Sindarov had in the second game that he won.
It's interesting that a4, like the engine actually dislikes this move, but it kind of feels correct to fix the a5 pawn on dark square. But for whatever reason, I think maybe like in the future after you play b3, it's just useful to be able to take with the a pawn. But a4 is super not, because you also don't want to allow white to play, to black to play a4. Mm. But like bishop d2, a4, maybe b3 now is just a better version. So anyway, he played a4, which I can't criticize, but it's kind of interesting. King d7, bishop c5, rook b8. Now you can't play b3. Rook e1, e5, king b1. So he's trying to play king a2, b3, e4. Mm-hmm. You see how black's pawns are advancing much easier than white's?
Yep. Big threat.
By the way, it was probably tempting to play like f3 instead of
king
b1,
maybe. Yeah.
But then after bishop g5, now if you trade bishops, it's actually losing. Take king e6. And the king just runs f5, f4.
Yeah.
And if you play king b1, then there's bishop d2, which is tactically something that's kind of scary, because take bishop c3, rook e7, king d8. And okay, there's some stuff on the queen side. It turns out it's okay after b3.
Certainly. Yes, certainly. You know, yeah.
It's a bit scary looking. So that's why he allowed the pawn to e4, most likely. Then king a2. Rook e8. But the problem is he's not achieving b3 anyway. And like black's pawns are very far advanced now. And the king actually is away. White's king is far away from black's potentially passed e-pawn. Like in the future, that could be a passed pawn. After f3, it actually is a passed pawn, tactically. So he played f3. And surprisingly, this is where the game ended. Bishop h4. Rook e2. Bishop g3, b3. And like now they just repeated moves. Like bishop b5, rook e3, and then bishop f4, rook e2, bishop b5, rook e3.
Yeah.
But after rook e3, actually could play bishop d6, and the position is borderline just losing for white. I mean, is it losing for sure? I don't know. But if you take on d6... I can even just take back bc4, king e5. And for all your, you know, extra pawn that you've gained, your king is on a2 and I have a passed e-pawn and I'm playing king f4. So to me, that looks like, yeah, maybe you survive, maybe not. You know, it's very scary looking.
That's a big opportunity, yeah.
And if you preserve the bishop with bishop b6, I can play c5. And this is actually, I think, just lost. Because your bishop actually gets trapped onto b6.
Yeah.
Like bc4, I think you just lose your bishop. In probably various ways. Like even dc4, I think, works, but also ef3, rook f3, king c6, just like you lose your bishop. So bishop d6 was a big opportunity. I can check with a really strong engine if it's just losing or not, but you know, it's maybe not even too important because practically speaking, it's a huge chance to win this position after bishop d6.
Yeah. No, big opportunity, perhaps, you know, Wei only had a minute on the clock. So definitely was a bit reluctant to make any huge decisions. But this was definitely an opportunity. And then this could have cost him. The fact that he hesitated at this point could have definitely cost him. Then we go into the game where Wei is white and some incredible things are happening.
I think we should probably skip to basically the end.
Yes.
Because it's an Italian. It's an equal position for forever, basically, as Italians tend to be.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point starts to go slightly wrong for Wei Yi. Like, I would say after BA6, BA6, like from this moment, it's still equal. He could play knight C6, for example. And this, I think, provokes a knight trade. And it's just an equal position. But he played king E3, G5, C5. Yeah, maybe C5 is where it really goes wrong. Because after G5, of course, he can play king D2, which I think is equal. Knight C6, which I think is equal. But he plays c5, and then he allows rook b8, and the problem is that now after knight a6, rook a8, the a-pawn is falling, because he played c5.
Uh-huh.
And then the black's rook gets active, and it starts to get very unpleasant. And so he played c6, rook a4, rook b5, knight d4. It's still a draw objectively. But black's knight on d4 is very... f3 is weak, knight on d4 is strong. It's a dangerous position.
Yep, absolutely.
And it started to go out of control. He was low on time. Then he was down two pawns. Engine still says, after rook h2, even down two pawns, it's still a drawish position. But I was looking out without an engine, and to me it felt like, I could also just be lost here with white, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure that's also what Wei Yi thought. I mean, he looked super calm. But
he always
but relatively,
does.
Yeah.
He always does.
I still felt like there was some nervousness there, and he got down to second on two occasions. First, when he played knight to f5, I think he played that with 1 second. And then when he played rook h7 with 1 second. And he also tends to make his last move a little bit slowly. The hand movement, it's something that you learn about players. And it can sometimes be important. Because some players tend to get down to 1 second. And there's, for example, I've played a million games with Ray Robson. He gets down to a second often, but he has a very fast hand movement at the end. Same with Lanier, for example.
Yes.
Very, very fast. So the second is safe. It's a safe 1 second. And it actually gets on your nerves a bit because you're always thinking, you see the 1 second. You're like, is my opponent going to flag? But they never do. Same with Lanier. Although he doesn't get down to 1 second super often, he has a very fast hand movement.
Mm-hmm.
Some guys like Wei Yi, for example, very slow hand movement. Sometimes it costs them. They get down to a second, they don't make their move in time. I've seen it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes even 2 seconds. It's just not enough time if your hand movement isn't fast enough. Fast hands, turns out, can be important. But Wei Yi, he made these very methodical rook h7 with 1 second. I think it was maybe approaching less than half a second at that point. It was very close. And after rook h7, I was watching this game again without an engine, with the commentary, and of course thinking about the position. After rook h7, I was thinking that I would play g4 here, and it turns out that after g4 rook g7, it's a draw, which is surprising to me. Rook g1, because you don't actually win the pawn, but you just play king to e3, for example. And my knight can't really go anywhere. Mm. It's a surprise. And then if I play king b6 to try to move my other pawn, then knight h6. So my G, and it's still not obvious, like knight H2, for example, the knight to F7. It's like, it's a draw, but it's extremely move by move. It's not like a forced draw or anything.
It's very concrete. Yep.
Black has a way to win here after rook H7, which is rook to A2. Or rook B2, but obviously rook B2 is just a far less logical version of the same idea, which is to give a check on A3 in a lot of cases, right?
Yep.
Now, for example, rook G7, rook 8, like the rook A3 is just so important because there's king C4, there's knight D2, and then you start to lose your E-pawn, which is the important one. And otherwise, if you get your king passive, like king C2, well, first of all, maybe knight D4 is just winning. Actually, it probably is. But also,
so
I can play...
So after rook A2, what would you play?
Well, I was just trying to kind of... I don't know what I would play. To be honest, a lot of people would give impulsive knight E7 check, but after king C5, then you just help white... You help black get the king active. Yeah. I think probably the, let's say, best chance is rook to e7. But that's a really weird move. The point is that after rook a3, king c4, now if knight d2, king b4, I'm attacking that e-pawn, which is more important than the g-pawn.
Yeah, you can give a check, kick my king all the way to the a-file, and yeah, rook c3 seems to be just winning.
I think basically there's like three tiers of moves here, because they're all losing. The first tier is the stupidest one. Knight e7 is just like impulse check, you know, panic, and the king c5, and you just help black win the game. Even easier. The second tier is rook g7. It's a kind of semi-useful move. But after rook a3, it's not the most semi-useful move. And then rook e7 is tier one. It's the most semi-useful move, and probably the best practical chance to keep fighting. What he would do, I don't know. Would he survive? I don't know. Certainly, it's a tough situation. It's very borderline if you survive this or not with black, with white, especially. Well, maybe the time actually helps you because, okay, you're down to 10 seconds, but your opponent also probably going to get down to 10 seconds, and you know you could easily screw up a position like this. It's very, people see winning, but this is not the, it's not the kind of methodical winning. Like if black's pawns were b7 d6, then that's methodical. I'm just up two pawns with no weaknesses. But e5, g5, c7, okay, there's weaknesses. I lose one pawn, can easily happen. You know, we saw just a few years before, if white had not played rook h7, then like maybe king e3 is a draw. It's a difficult position. Like, not just even objectively, it's difficult for engines to evaluate it properly.
Yeah.
But Andre played king b6, which... Wei immediately saw the refutation of this move. I also, to be honest, I was also looking in the direction of 93 when I was looking at the board. So I also was like, wait, 93? And then you give a check on d2 and king c3. And now there's also knight c4. There's knight d5 threatened, and there's knight c4.
You lose and a pawn.
But not only do you lose a pawn, you also lose a pawn with check, like knight d5 check. And then wherever the king goes, it's going to be another check to gain that pawn. So you also... to be honest, I think after 93, you just make a draw with white. There's no serious risk anymore.
Yeah.
Like, if you're playing an engine, 91, king c4, rook e2, 95, and now king c6, very important. So if rook c7, there's king d6.
Yeah.
An engine, of course, would pose you very significant issues still in time trouble. But humanly, after 93, I think you just make a draw, you know, 90% of the time. It's just a very drawish position. So Andre, I was watching the video, he's kind of reaching for his rook, rook d2. He sees, of course, king c3, there's the knight c4 check, there's no c6. Rook d2, king c3, you can't play c6, you want to play c6, but you can't play c6. He realizes it's a draw, and then with about 10 seconds left or so, maybe this there's this kind of type of player which is very comfortable getting down to the last second. And... it is a helpful skill to have, because if you're comfortable getting down to your last second, you actually have a bit more buffer time to not panic. Mm. But I think that Yessipenko is probably not one of those players. And so he always wants to keep like a 10-second buffer. And I'm just trying to explain what happened on his next move. So he was thinking rook d2, king c3. He was thinking maybe rook g3. A lot of things were flashing through his mind. And then he thought... okay, my rook on d2 runs into knight c4 check. So I'll just play c6 immediately.
Mm.
Which, of course, he had seen that the rook was hanging. But he momentarily forgot about it. he played c6, which of course just hangs a rook and is frankly a ridiculous way to lose a match of this importance.
It's the worst way. It's the stuff of nightmares. Like, it's the type of moment that stays with you for the rest of your career, and probably you will be having nightmares for a very long time, reminiscing this moment.
Okay, I mean, I've been through some painful defeats, yes. or draws. I've been through some very stupid blunders, which is not even necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think if you never had a painful moment in chess, that just means that you haven't had much success.
But you don't want to have too many, right?
You don't want to have too many, of course, but it's also the nature of any, you know, long chess playing career that you're going to have a lot. It just depends on what you mean as many. Mm. Like, Magnus has many.
Sure.
For sure, painful moments. He just has also many more very good moments. But when you've been playing chess for 20, 30 years, or more, if you're talking about a guy like Vichy, for example, you've been through hundreds of painful moments. You know, talking about a guy like Vichy, who was 5-time world champion, for example, and also Rapid and Blitz world champion and so on, you know, he could probably list you the amount of painful moments that have happened in either finals of like World Cup, World Championship, match against Gary. I mean, also close calls that he had, you know, losing in his match against Gelfand, losing the game there, and his, you know, any guy who's been super successful, and sometimes even the more successful, the more painful moments you've had.
Yeah.
Will point to a million painful moments. So from my experience, depending on how bad it is, you can think about it for anywhere from a night to a week, or maybe 2 weeks. But eventually you get over it, I think. Mm-hmm. Something like this, to be honest, it's also, I mean, it really sucks, especially for his match.
Yeah.
But he also has a match to play for third place. And if he wins the match for third place, I actually don't even think he'll care too much about this game.
He will not. Yeah, he will not. He will not, of course, because again, he accomplishes what everybody wants from that tournament, qualifies as candidates.
It could be the difference between third and first. It could be the difference between third and second. The difference between third and second, to be honest, is not even that. It's just money.
Yeah.
The difference between third and first, okay, that feels like, I mean, you want to win a tournament, but you're still pretty happy with third, I think. If he does lose a third place match against Yakubov, which of course I would say it's a 50-50, which is not my default, so I don't have to predict anything.
You would say it's 50-50 right now, even with the current mental situation, psychological situation.
Yeah, they both lost a match. What's the current cycle?
Yeah, but Osipenko lost it in a very different manner, right? Or you don't think it matters too much?
A loss is a loss.
A loss is a loss, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. And like on paper, Osipenko also, actually, I don't, maybe not by rating, but he's,
yeah, Kubov is higher like, right now.
Yeah, that's true. It's a 50-50. I mean, Yespenko's had the higher rating historically. Yakubov has the slightly higher rating currently. If you want, we could take
wager
bets.
A bet.
Yeah,
you want to wager a bet? Okay.
I mean, I'll take Yespenko and Sindarov, and okay.
I'll take the other two. Yes.
I mean, I'm taking the lower rated players, so it's feels like maybe not the best bet from my point of view, but
it's a good bet. Like, yeah, whatever you pick, it's a good bet.
No,
like,
if I'm saying it's 50-50 in both matches, that's my...
It seems that's like what I'm that's, saying. That might be the case. But sure, I'll happily take Yakubov, and Wei has been my pick, my consistent horse for a while. Not from the beginning, but for a while. Like, I always... Huh. I also picked him against Arjun. I got a little bit lucky on that one, but he went through.
No, I mean, you didn't get lucky in that match. That was just a good match from Wei, right?
Well, Arjun had some chances, but yes.
Yeah, in the classical, that's true. Yeah,
in classical.
In rapid, it was actually just he was the one kind of calling the shots for the most part. That's what it felt like. But look, I think that Wei did show some weakness in this match against Yesipenko. I mean, he was much better and then just agreed to a draw. And mm-hmm. then he wasn't in control in the second game at all. He didn't play badly or anything, but he wasn't in control. So, and Sindarov to me in rapid looked really, really good. I also don't think that Wei will have the openings to disturb him too much in classical.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we could just see draws in classical and then back to rapid, to be honest, in both matches. But
yeah,
but we could also see, but I would think like if there's going to be a decisive game, it's more likely in classical, I mean, it's more likely to be in the Yakubov-Yesipenko match. And in the other match, I think Sindarov-Wei, like two draws is very likely in classical.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then in rapid, I mean, to be honest, Sindarov played so well in rapid against Yakubov that I don't even feel like... Wei is also... I mean, he did... Wei won... Oh, no, he didn't win. But he got in the Poland Warsaw Grand Chess Tour Rapid and Blitz. He was leading the whole time, and then Magnus eked it out in the end. But he had like 25.5 points. It was a really good score. I mean, he's a very good Rapid and Blitz player. But you know, it's Sindarov is also a very good Rapid and Blitz player. So it's I don't know. It's a close one. Also, yeah. The thing is that this match, I think they're just both happy to be there. I mean, they both qualify.
They are. That's the thing.
They can kind of relax a little bit in that sense. You know, it feels a bit, not like a free roll, but, you know, it feels good to be there and not at least not having to sweat the candidates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, 100%. Obviously, it's a huge result if you manage to win the World Cup. It's more cash, but at the same time, the big reason behind being for so long at the World Cup is to qualify the candidates, give yourself a chance to become a world champion, and both of these players have it right now. So once again, congratulations. You will be meeting them in Cyprus in April. Are you excited about these two players joining the fray?
I don't know. It feels weird for me to say excited or not. I'm not excited about anyone.
That, and you don't need to give too much.
No, but it's
too
on
much
like,
detail.
I mean, it's players I have to play against. Is sure, it's exciting. Maybe if you want to watch chess, you know, exciting to watch. But it's not. I mean, it's an
they
exciting
are two
tournament.
Players that are making it for the first time to the candidates.
Sure,
we haven't.
It's
seen
an exciting tournament in the sense that. I mean, the stakes are very high. There's a lot to play for. There's a lot of motivation, but whoever I play against, it's not like I'm excited about them. But of course, yeah, for the people watching, I mean, Wei and Sindarov, they're both first time qualifying. You could say for Wei, it's a long time in coming. For Sindarov, it's his first opportunity since he's only 19, which is... it's actually interesting because, like, for me, when I first qualified for the candidates, it was 2016. So I was 23. Because it was early in the year. 23 mm-hmm. years old. First time playing. And I actually reached my highest rating when I was 22 in 2014. Because, like, the chances, I don't know what it was, maybe. Maybe there's just less opportunity to qualify or maybe just circumstance. But I mean, I had a serious chance in the 2013-14 qualification circuit to qualify for the Hanti-Mansisk candidates in 2014, the one which Vishy Anand won to re-qualify for the World Championship match against Magnus. And then it was down to this, what they called the Grand Prix, which is actually the way I qualified the next year. I was first in the Grand Prix 2014-15, and Hikaru Nakamura was second. We both qualified for the Moscow candidates 2016. And in that one, the system was you would play a series of tournaments, and they would count your top, I think, four results. out of five tournaments or something like that, or maybe top three out of four. So I played first in Tashkent. I played in, or first in Baku. I'm mixing up tournaments. Tashkent, Thessaloniki. The last one was Paris. There was also one in Beijing, which I didn't play. I can't remember all the events. But anyway, the top three at the end of it, and two qualified. The top three was Veselin Topalov, Shakhriyar Mamedyarov. They qualified, and I got third, and I got out. Mm-hmm. If you had counted all the events, I would have qualified. But they had the system where you dropped the weakest performance.
Yeah.
And Topalov had one last place finish. And so that last place finish, he actually didn't get penalized for because it got dropped out. But I didn't have any super bad tournaments. All of mine were fine. Uh-huh. So it didn't benefit me at all. It was a bit of a weird system in that sense. I thought, like, why would you eliminate one performance? It makes no sense. You played the whole tournament. Why do you eliminate the performance? But anyway, that was a system they had.
Yeah.
Anyway, a brief dip into the past.
Into history. Yes. I love it. Cool. Fabi, very excited for the finals. Very excited probably for the other match. More excited than for the finals, because that's where we're going to see the competitive aspects that we all enjoy, you know, the nerves and the stakes being at the highest. And obviously, we'll see who makes it next to the candidates. It's between Essipenko and Yakubov. We could be seeing two Uzbek players for the very first time in a very long time, since Rustam somewhat, you know, won the world championship.
Never two, right? Never two.
Never two, of course not. No. Never two. No, two.
I mean,
two Uzbek players, that's huge. I think they had one top player for a very long time. That was Rustam, but they never had anybody close to him.
I'm actually kind of curious. Was there anyone, because the 2004 world championship was a knockout?
Yes.
Was there any other Uzbek player besides Rustam playing? Rustam was the winner. But of course, I mean, Uzbekistan did have other good players, so it was possible there was someone else there.
Good players, but nowhere close to even 2,700.
No, but it's a knockout. No, there was Barsov was also playing.
But what was his rating?
I mean, 2,507. It was a knockout tournament. He was actually about middle of the pack. But Uzbekistan did have some good players in the past. Just, of course, this is the strongest they've ever been because they have Noderbek, I was Tarov 27 plus, 2730 plus. Okay, obviously he was much higher, so he's actually on one of his lower ratings. Sindarov and Yakubov and a bunch of other very strong grandmasters like Vokidov.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this is the strongest they've been.
By far.
But yeah, the last time that there was an Uzbek player playing in basically the last steps of the World Championship cycle was 2005 when Rustam played in the knockout tournament in, I think it was Mexico. No, sorry, San Luis in Argentina.
Yeah.
Which was won by Veselin Topalov.
Yeah. No. Great opportunity right now, obviously, for Uzbekistan. I'm sure Yakubov still hopes and will give his best to try to join his good friend and compatriot to the candidates. But yeah, exciting few days. And once again, Fabi, thanks for joining. Thanks for sharing your ideas about the games, about the psychology between these players, the key moments of these matches. I think everybody following chess and following the World Cup will get to enjoy your insights as well. So thanks again for that. And yeah, we'll see you guys in the next episode. Don't forget, like, subscribe, all the good stuff. Help spread the word about C-Squared and what we do on this channel, and help us reach our goal, which the next milestone is, of course, 100K on YouTube. So help us get there quick. Cheers, guys. See you in the next one. Bye-bye.